All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And so, you know, Sandy, we were continuing our discussion on where we are, just where we are in this nation, and it's probably one of the most dangerous times in this nation's history in a long, long time. And the worst part about it is you see it developing. Those of us who, you know, kind of focus on these things, that certainly a lot less people who focus on these things than who do. But we're at a point where you and I were talking about this during the break. Donald Trump and the role he plays in all of this. One man.
Well, I think he's a symptom. And I think it's one of these things that was bound to happen. Maybe there'd be somebody like him who could read the tea leaves or at least sense them. I'm not sure he could read them. I think his instincts took him there to seize the sort of populist power that the situation was creating the capacity for. So we've got Donald Trump, and we've got this guy who gets beaten in an election, but instead of accepting defeat, he decides to devise a strategy for coming up with a theory as to why he ought to stay in power, which is appealing to the people who are, for instance, in a power structure that feels that he represents the power that their structure wants to maintain, this old power structure. And as it slips away, they decide they can embrace a wild theory as well. Okay, but then now what happens? Now what happens going forward after January 6th, after this episode that came so very close? And we were talking off the air about what had happened if Michael Pence had decided he could, as vice president, decide who would be president, and he would have decided in favor of Donald Trump. What would have happened then? What would we have done?
You know, Sandy, and I said that the nation would have done the only thing it could possibly do, and to remain one nation would to be to come in and do what they would have to do.
Well, what is that though? I mean, is it a military move? If it's a military move, what do all those people? We had an election that was about 83 million to 76 million or 75 million votes. That's 158 million, 159 million people voting. Almost half of those people were apparently strong Trump supporters. So now we decide that Trump has been made president in what is probably an illegitimate process, is an illegitimate process. And what happens then? And if it is a military, if it's essentially federal marshals, the military, who calls them out? The president is the one who has the power over them. There's no new president unless somehow Biden can assert the powers of a presidency to do it. So you can see there's a bunch of mechanical difficulties associated and legal difficulties associated with what is the response. But let's just say that the military does decide to do this. First of all, will the military respond, or is some of the military so conservative in its outlook that they would divide over this and you'd have a split military? I mean, there's almost no response to that doesn't result in essentially a civil war.
You know, I've said this, that we are closer to a civil war, another civil war, than people can imagine, with people being as heavily armed as they are.
Right.
That could conceivably take place. And, you know, with Donald Trump,
Well, let me just jump in one thing. I said, you know, what about would the military have been cohesively in support of taking a stand that would not permit Michael Pence to decide who's going to be president, we should understand that it looks like the Secret Service could have been involved in the whole conspiracy, if we want to call it that, to have Michael Pence be disabled at least from being, not being, from refusing to do it. You know, we've got this situation now where these tapes are can't be found with respect, or the records and the phones can't be found about what the Secret Service was doing at the time. And then we have Michael Pence, who apparently was suspicious enough about the Secret Service that he refused to get in the car.
So let's do this. Phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. What is your level of trust in our government now? And you can say, well, those people are no longer in charge. But even if that's the case, and you say that those people are no longer in charge, does it give you a pause to say, well, the Democrats are in charge of that government now? Does it mean you have even more trust, or is your trust more so in a party? Because I think this is bigger than any party.
Well, let's run that one out forward. Let's say in 2024 at the Republican convention in Milwaukee, Donald Trump does try to secure the nomination for the presidency. And let's say that in a close contest, he loses the contest to get the Republican nomination for president. And someone like DeSantis gets it. Will Donald Trump then simply applaud the new Republican nominee and support
him?
No,
he's never going to do that.
No. And so let's say that he decides that he's been cheated by the Republican Party, and that the Republican Party has become part of this international conspiracy against which he is running, and is part of the deep swamp that his people need to overcome. And if you play that forward, you can kind of get to the same outcome that we were worried about with the January 6th insurrection.
So Sandy, do you then think that there's been no preparation within the government knowing where we are, knowing what took place, and that it has not prepared itself in some way, shape, or form this happens again?
I think governments are, it's almost impossible to devise a government that can deal with an incumbent who's unwilling to go through the process of a fair and peaceful transfer of power to a successor, because that president is the commander-in-chief of the military, and there isn't anyone else under the process of government that is. And that power, and that's one of the reasons why we've held as so sacred this notion of a peaceful transfer of power. It's why Al Gore, I think, and others have always participated in it, because they understand it at some level. And a person like Donald Trump, and maybe a movement that he is the representative of, don't understand it.
You know, Sandy, it is a scary time. It really is, because there are no answers ready that we can pat answers, right? There are no pat answers for where we go from there. And people could say, well, we don't have to worry about it. Donald Trump is not going to be a player anyway, because he's not going to wind up with the nomination. But that's no guarantee. The people who supported him, even though you hear them say they're not supporters of him, when he gets back on the scene, many of them are still clamoring for him.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who say something bad's going to happen in 2024. I had this nice fellow that was from the Boston area. I rode on a plane from Newark down to Florida with him, and he was a blue collar owner of a business, and near the end of the conversation we started talking about politics. He was clearly a Trump supporter, and he's a gun owner, in fact a multiple gun owner. He said he always carried a gun. I said, now why do you do that? And he said, because something bad is going to happen in this country, and I'm going to be armed and ready. And I realized later that I think what he was talking about was the kind of insurrection that could develop in 2024 or sometime in the future over issues that are associated with these social political issues.
You know, Sandy, all of those thoughts are real. They can happen. And we're not so separated from them. You know, again, we still in our minds, this is America. That stuff won't happen here. Right? I mean, yeah. There's nothing to point out prior to January 6th that those kind of things could have ever happened in this country. Not to the magnitude that it did. And now since it has happened, then we know it can happen again, but on a grander scale.
Yeah, I mean, here we are. It's just a little bit after Bastille Day, but I'll bet you on July 12th, back in the day in France, there wasn't a great deal of belief that July 14th and Bastille Day would happen in France either. You know, I mean, I don't think revolutions are necessarily things that are easily foreseen. If they were easily foreseen, the people in power would use their power to try and quash them preemptorily. You know, they would preempt them. But I just think that these things well up and then they burst.
Yeah, well, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. So Sandy, yesterday I was at, what is the name of the park? How can I keep forgetting this? Excuse me. Beautiful park on the east side, Estabrook Park.
Yeah.
And the Milwaukee Democrats, that guy should put on a shirt, right? the Milwaukee Democrats had a gathering, and so I was invited, and I met some people there, and probably some of them are listening this morning. Good morning to you. But I was talking about the divide between the millennials and the baby boomers. And the Democrats have more than just a problem trying to defeat the Republicans. They've got this divide between the younger voters and the baby boomers. And they better figure out a way to get that worked out. Because in my conversations with some of the millennials, they wanted to see the student loans overturned.
Mm-hmm.
they're not alone. They represented a whole lot of young people in this country who are Democrats who think that that should be done immediately. And it's not as easy as I think many of the millennials think it is. And
well, I think there's a lot of the boomers who would say, I'd like my mortgage forgiven, too. I know. I'm not saying that's the fair response to it, but I'm saying there's this divide between the people who have student loans and those who don't. And the ones who don't have student loans, who are the boomers, right, are not as sympathetic to the situation because they view it as possibly an inequitable use of federal government money to spare some people the problems of their debts. But to me, the student loan issue really relates to the question of whether we shouldn't have public education going all the way up through college and graduate school, as they do in almost all the other developed countries. And it's another reflection of the problem we have in America with our social safety net, if some people want to call it that. You know, we have a health care problem because we don't have public health care, at least public health care funding for everyone. We have a daycare problem because we don't provide daycare and we have an education student loan problem because we don't provide education all the way up through graduate school to the people who can't afford private education.
So the millennials are frustrated, angry,
yeah,
because apparently, and I don't remember it, but apparently President Biden promised them
During the campaign, there were promises, and I remember that the price tag on that promise varied. I think he finally came around to at the end of the campaign saying he would forgive loans up to $50,000.
Which hasn't happened.
So I think they're right that there was a presidential electioneering promise of about $50,000, which hasn't happened.
But if the alternative is, okay, so he didn't give us what we wanted, so we're not going to vote for him. I mean, what's the alternative to that? And in my conversations with some of those young people on yesterday, they didn't give me an answer to that. But if the alternative is you're not going to vote and you want the Republicans to get to wind up in that position of power, do you think they're going to forgive the student loan?
Well, I suppose their position is, it wasn't forgiven under a Democrat, so we don't care who gets elected because they're not going to forgive it either.
And I think your assessment is right.
Yeah. So that ignores all the other issues.
Yes, I hope. Yeah. And you know, the millennials are a critical component to whether or not Democrats can win.
Well, I think part of the problem is that The boomers just haven't handed power over. You know, what do we have? Joe Biden, he's 78, 79 years old. Now they talk, well, if Joe doesn't run, who? And then Hillary Clinton's name resurfaces again. And how old is she? She's probably going to be 76 or some such number if she ran again. So, you know, we need to hand power over to younger people, and at least those people could feel like they weren't totally unrepresented. They could at least be represented by someone closer in the age to them and closer in outlook to them.
Well, so that's incumbent upon the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Then
let's go through the list of potential Democratic leaders in this country, and we'll find out that you and I can't even list four, probably.
Well, not young.
Not young. Let's okay. List. Let's,
the only one I can think of.
People have to be younger than 60 years old. Now let's list some.
The number one person that I would think of is Pete Buttigieg.
Okay, there's one.
And then Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
Then Pete Buttigieg. So they're not there. They have not cultivated.
Right.
The people who come up after them. And so all you have to do is look down the list. Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
Chuck Schumer.
Right.
You know, these people have been around.
I mean, those are the legislative leaders, but, you know, there is the Governor Newsom of California would fall
yes.
on that list. And so what the Democrats need to do is they need to start formulating and having leaders in the Democratic Party who are of an age that can be viewed as being people with a view of the future. I mean, They're reprehensible people, but if you list the potential presidential candidates from the Republican Party, they're probably all in their 50s.
Well,
I mean, Ted Cruz. Oh, God, what a horrible guy.
Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio, yeah. DeSantis, Ron DeSantis. These people are all younger, much materially younger in age.
You know, we've got Democrats listening. Our phone line's open at 844-967-2789. What do you say? Because, again, this conversation has to be had. And in my conversation with the young people on yesterday, and I would say these the young people I was talking to had to be in their late 20s, and they're politically engaged, and so they're frustrated because they're politically engaged. And there are a lot of young millennials who are politically engaged. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and that group of people, and they want to see some changes. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. Can I speak for both of us in this?
and you can speak for both of us about both being young. About the old goats thing.
But Sandy.
What do you mean we?
So I'm just saying, this is a real issue that the Democrats have to deal with on top of all the other things. How do they work that through? And when they made the decision to go with Joe Biden because they said he's the only one that can defeat Donald Trump, I remember distinctly when they said this is the reason we're going with Joe, because we don't think any of these other people has a snowball chance in hell to beat Donald Trump. Joe is tried and true. He's steady. We know who he is.
Well, to be honest with you, I think I might have even participated in that thought process. I went through this brief flurry with Michael Bloomberg, thinking this guy could be a savior, and that was a brief meeting.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah. But then, you know, it was...
Well, you thought he was safe, right?
Yeah, I thought he was safe. I did worry about age. I didn't worry enough about that. And I do think that I don't think Joe Biden's done anything badly. I just think he hasn't filled the office with the vigor that people with hope want their president to
But you
operate.
Talk about age. Bloomberg's got to be similar in age.
I know. I was foolish.
Right.
I mean, it had to do with vigor.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and vigor and experience. But I think I kind of sorted through my brain, why is it that the Democrats have only older leaders? And I think it's because they've been a relatively powerful party, at least on a national plurality basis, for a long time. And so the people who are in power in the party have not had to give it up because the party has exhibited power, and so have they. So, you know, the people who had power in the party in the year 2000 continue to be there and be in power. And it's the party out of power that tends to develop a bunch of young pretenders who are fighting to become the leaders of their party. That's what happened to the Democrats in the 1990s, and that's what's happened to the Republicans in the subsequent period. So the Republicans have a bunch of young people. None of them have had power, but they're a substantial number of pretenders who we can list the names of. And the Democratic side, not many pretenders, because the incumbents have had so much power.
Well, some may say that the Democrats are playing it safe. They always play it safe. They know who these people are that they have, and they're comfortable with them. I see Connor's throwing his hands up. Oh, okay. And they're comfortable with them. But again, that's, you know, you're in my time. We were We were comfortable. I know who Chuck Schumer is. I know who Nancy Pelosi is. I know who Joe Biden is. I know who the guy down in Carolina.
Lindsey Graham? No.
No, the black guy who supported...
Biden.
Joe Biden. I forgot his name. But anyway, you know who those guys are, who those women are. But those times, man, we gotta move beyond those times. And we keep talking about giving young people a chance. That's gotta be more than just talk, right?
Well, yeah, power.
They did for a moment with Barack Obama. They could say that we did show that we did step back and allow, you know,
right.
one guy, but he was, you know, a little bit different than the rest. He was, he had that old spirit in him, even though he was a young guy.
Well, actually, he did. The people he defeated for his nomination did include some other young folk, and maybe that was another one of those periods where we had a party out of power with a number of pretenders, including Barack Obama. He was, you know, he was very good about bowing out of power when he ended his presidency, and did the sort of the appropriate thing of letting power shift to his successors. But it left a vacuum, and into that vacuum stepped the old names.
You know, Sandy. So this is. An article I was reading this morning is from The Hill, and it says that cracks from the Biden's Senate Democratic base. Cracks are beginning to form in President Biden's support among Senate Democrats who are becoming less bullish about him running for re-election in 2024. Let me ask you something, Sandy. If Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin had not done what they did, would we be talking about this? Because if Joe Biden was able to get Build Back Better through,
yeah,
would we be talking about this?
I don't know. It would be interesting because, to some extent, the presidency is a personality cult issue. And I think to that, from the standpoint of the personality cult and charisma, Joe Biden comes up short. But from the standpoint of accomplishing things, if you're right, if Manchin and Sinema had not blocked the passage of the couple of other initiatives that had a big impact, there would have been a fair amount that could be pointed at as accomplishments out of the Biden administration. So he would have accomplished a bunch of things.
Right.
Which were positives. I think he would still possibly fail the cult of the personality issue. Of course, so did Richard Nixon. That man had a negative personality, if any at all. So I think, I don't know if we would be. I think we probably would not be having this conversation.
I think we would not be having this conversation because the safety net that you often reference would have been in place.
Well, some of it would have been in
place. Yeah, not all of it, because Republicans still had...
Well, but I mean, the prongs of what he wanted didn't really complete that safety net. I'm not sure... I was disappointed with how it was addressing, for instance, child daycare, because I think it was a child daycare tax credit rather than a child daycare program. And my concern about tax credits and handing money out is that you can say you're handing it out for a purpose, but whether it gets expended for that purpose is totally outside the control of the government. So I'm much more comfortable. If we want to have child daycare provided by the federal government, then we ought to have child daycare programs funded by the federal government and not having a child daycare
so tax what,
credits.
So what we would have had would have been some framework. Whether or not it would have been, you know, completed is another story. But, you know, had those things not been blocked by Sinema and Manchin, the framework would have been there, and he would have gotten credit for that.
Yes. Yeah.
But as it stands now, he doesn't get credit for any of those things. And so now people wonder, well, okay, and we keep forgetting, Sandy, it hasn't even been a full 2 years yet.
Well, I mean, the problem is that the economy, you know, that the incumbent you know, when it's your incumbent, you could say it's not fair that he's getting treated this
right.
way. When it's not your incumbent, you definitely jump on the bandwagon of blaming them for the economic circumstance that is unpleasant during the period. So there's no question that an incumbent will suffer to some extent from the issue of general economic conditions in the country, and I fear that the general economic conditions in this country are not going to be very positive come the 2024 election.
So it, could it have been that it didn't matter who would have been the president, the economic conditions we are dealing with right now might have been inevitable, they were going to come regardless?
I think a lot of the things that have created it were already in motion before. Obviously, Biden didn't create this in the last 2 years. I mean, the pandemic had a lot to do with it. The tariff trade war that Trump initiated had a lot to do with it, and the breakdown of the supply chain. The pandemic, you know, fractured the supply chain, and the war in Ukraine has had a huge international impact.
All right, we've got to go to a break. Phone lines are open, 844-967-2789, Texas, at the same number. Sandy Williams is in the studio. We'll be back.
Baby, Grandma understands that you really love that band. Put yourself in Jesus' hands. Grandma's hands, then Grandma's hands used to hand me a piece of candy. Grandma's hands picked me up each time I fell. Oh, Grandma's hands, boy, they really came in handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for grandma's hand.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789 in Texas, that same number. Sandy Williams is here, as always, on Mondays and Fridays. Today is Monday. Or is it Friday?
It's Monday.
Oh, it's Monday. Okay, it's Monday. If you say so. Sandy, Ukraine. Still in the news, and a little bit more now than it was. There's some things going on internally in Ukraine. And, you know, you wanted to talk about the fact that there are some folk inside Ukraine who don't agree totally with Zelensky.
Well, apparently, I mean, Zelensky announced that he was essentially firing the head of the security and a whole bunch of other of essentially almost cabinet-level people for collaboration with the Russians. And of course, the Zelensky government and the Western press is covering this as if these people are traitorously acting against the Ukrainian interest, which apparently they might be. But the question really is, are these people evidence simply of traitors within a government for a country that is unanimously backing Zelensky and in the position of Ukraine against Russia? Or are these people evidence that there are, in fact, within Ukraine, a number of very influential people, as well as maybe they represent a substantial number of Ukrainians, who are not sympathetic with the way Zelensky's handling things and might be closer to sympathetic with the Russian position, which is the way Russia would present this. So the Western press covers this one way. I'm confident that the Russian press is covering this as further proof that there are many, many supporters within Ukraine of the Russian position against the Zelensky government. And where is the truth in that situation. I mean, the fact is that over the past while, Zelensky has uncovered a substantial number of collaborators. And whether they're called collaborators, sympathizers with Russia, or traitors is a question of vantage point.
You know, Sandy, we can, you know, Zelensky's the hero now. Prior to this war, weren't a lot of people who really even knew who Zelensky was. And the way he came into power, having been a comedian and not having a whole lot of history with the government and all those types of things, and the battle that he's waged, and so people are now, when they look and see Zelensky, they see just a great warrior. But when you don't have a history or of that nation and an insight on its war machine and all of those things, you gotta kind of figure Zelensky's still kind of a novice at this.
Well, he might be politically savvy, but you have to understand that the domestic politics of Ukraine might be quite complicated, and apparently they were. There is a strident right-wing conservative side that is very nationalistic and very apparently aggressive. And that is part of the Zelensky wing of government. He represents a center-right government, and maybe it's a right-of-center government. And so he has to listen to those supporters. It is understood by many that Zelensky was potentially willing to negotiate with Putin before the invasion at the time they surrounded. And, however, there were significant portions of his right-wing government that said, no way, you can't do that. Now that this war is ongoing, I'm confident that there are at least some in the government, as well as many in the populace, who might want at least there to be negotiations ongoing towards a settlement of the war. And there is some intelligence that leads people to believe that it is at least as much Zelensky who's refusing to negotiate as it might be the Russians, with Zelensky believing that with the development of more armament from the West and stronger military capacity by on the part of Ukraine, that they will improve their negotiating position for a peace. And so there's much bloodshed, and there's much Ukrainian treasure and blood that's being spent now based on the policies of Zelensky in terms of continuing the warfare with Russia and continuing the defense, rather than negotiating potentially towards a peace which might be no different than the peace that he could have had earlier, which, as I've said, was the Donbass region being redefined, a recognition of the Crimea annexation, and an announced long-term neutrality for Ukraine. And so, you know, maybe these collaborators are simply people who are strong disbelievers in the policy being pursued by Zelensky of continued warfare.
Well, you know, that continued warfare is...
I mean, it is a defense, and I understand that it's continuing warfare from the standpoint of defending your country is different than continuing warfare in an attack on another country. But still, the process of negotiation takes two to tango, and it could well be that there's a lack of cohesion on the part of the Ukrainian people, but also some significant political and government participants on the issue of just what and how negotiations should run.
Well, you know, Sandy, there was, and I'm looking for it. I had it earlier, but I don't know it. It kind of disappeared. But what it was really talking about was that the article, and I forgot where I had it, was talking about what may be the final decision on this war, and that this winds up like the Korean War, where there's a North Korea and a South Korea, right. But this split and divide with Crimea, I mean with Russia and Ukraine,
right? With right. That split is basically Eastern Ukraine, meaning the Donbas, being on the Russian side, and Western Ukraine remaining as the independent Ukraine that is under the Zelensky government now, and Crimea being a continued part of Russia.
Well, actually, here it is. Russia and Ukraine bound for Korean War ending. And so when you talk about Korean War ending, former NATO Supreme Ally Commander James Stavridis said Sunday that the Russian-Ukraine war will likely end in 4 to 6 months and have a resolution similar to the Korean War in the 1950s.
Well, interestingly, the Korean War never ended. The resolution that resolved the Korean War created the boundary between North and South Korea, but there was never peace signed. And that's one of the problems we have ongoing with Korea, is that we have the strange armistice that was signed that was never a peace. And the problem with that outcome from the standpoint of a settlement is that if we have that kind of a settlement, we have no end to the sanctions. And the sanctions do threaten NATO continuity to some extent. There's already, today I heard news that there were a number of turbines that were necessary for this Nord Stream, this pipeline that runs from Russia, the gas and oil pipeline. It's been shut down for 10 days for maintenance. One of the reasons it has been is that Siemens Company, which is a German company, which has built the turbines that are used and lie partially in Russia at least, for creating the pressure that is necessary to move the water, gas and oil from Russia to Europe, are in need of maintenance. And the sanctions had kept the parts from being shipped to Russia. And so that was causing this 10-day shutdown, and Europe is worried about the 10-day shutdown being made permanent, and then they've got no gas and oil coming from Russia, which turns out to be a serious problem. And so most recently, there's been some exceptions made to the sanctions. Equipment has been shipped to Canada where there is a Siemens plant that can repair them, and they're doing emergency repairs. So there's already some breaks in the unity here.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back.